This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And on the line with us is our old friend Jamal Abdi with the National Iranian American Council, NIAC, NIAC.org is the website. And Jamal, welcome back to the program.
Hey, how are you, Tom?
Great. Great to have you with us. Big news, I think, tell me if it is or not, the European Union, this is from The Hill, the European Union, the EU, is warning businesses, European businesses specifically, that cut ties with Iran over new U.S. sanctions, that those firms could face EU sanctions. This is a quote from Nathalie Tosi, an aide to the EU's foreign policy head, that she told BBC Radio 4 yesterday. If EU companies abide by U.S. secondary sanctions, they will in turn be sanctioned by the EU. We're doing this in order to signal diplomatically to the Iranians that Europeans are serious about the Iran nuclear agreement. And the EU said on Monday that it would forbid European entities from complying with the sanctions. What's going on here?
The EU is fighting back. They announced that they would take this step, these blocking sanctions. They've done these in the past. It really, you know, it's a question now of how strictly will the EU actually enforce this? Will they actually have some bite to their bark and seriously, you know, go after their own companies who comply with the sanctions?
Mm-hmm.
I think that's up in the air, and there is more that the EU would need to do in order to not just have the costs for companies doing business with Iran, but also creating some, you know, banking channels, exploring ways that, you know, oil exports could continue through some sort of trading or bartering mechanism. So this is really, you know, I think this is a symbolic step. I think the EU has showed that it is very serious about protecting this deal. But the actual practical implications that remain to be seen. We've already seen European companies leaving.
Yeah, Daimler left. If it's mostly big German companies that are leaving, and Germany basically has the muscle to you know, change EU policy, is that the source of your skepticism? Or a source?
That is a source. I think that I think that large German companies probably will test this proposition. Now, I don't know that for sure, but it's a matter of, does the political will exist for the EU to actually carry out these measures?
So,
and really,
go ahead.
It's a game of chicken now between sort of Donald Trump and the EU.
So Standard Chartered Bank, which is a UK chartered bank, but they have U.S. branches and U.S., you know, they do business in the United States. In fact, they're one of their biggest branches is at 1095 Avenue of the Americas in New York. They are licensed to operate in Iran. And for among international banks, only about 25% of them are actually licensed to operate in Iran. So should Standard Chartered Bank in New York City be closed? I mean, is there any discussion of this? And then I want to get into where all this is going. I mean, if we're leading ourselves toward war with Iran.
Well, on your first question, that is what I would expect. I would actually, you know, this is the Trump administration posing to the rest of the world and these banks and companies, you either do business with Iran or you can do business with us. You can't do both. And so all the indications are that this administration is going to go after everybody, you know, as strictly as they can. So I, you know, for now, I think they're following up on those threats. We've seen them back down a little bit on the oil sanctions, but we'll see how much of this is bluster and how willing they are to actually go after these companies.
Yeah, I just find it breathtaking that the Trump administration thinks that we can say to Britain or China or Chile or even Zambia, you know, if you do business with Iran, you can't do business with us. It blows my mind. Is this a standard in past sanctions? I mean, is this the normal way that sanctions are done?
The sanctions on Iran are really the some of the broadest sanctions ever created. So these sanctions, you know, these are sanctions that came into force under the Obama administration, largely driven by Congress. But as far as the Obama administration was concerned, their role was to make sure that the rest of the world was actually bought into these sanctions.
Right.
And so they actually held off Congress for a long time. Well, not a long time, but they held Congress off so they could actually go to the UN, get approval for this, get the rest of the world to actually buy in. So it was much different. I don't think we've ever seen something quite like this where it's the United States versus the rest of the world in terms of enforcing its sanctions.
That's bizarre. So if we continue with this, and particularly in November, if we start blocking oil exports out of Iran, I understand already, and please fact check me on this, that the value of the Iranian currency has dropped by at least 70%, which means that everybody in Iran, at least on an international basis, is, you know, two-thirds less wealthy or three-quarters less wealthy than they used to be, than they were just a year ago, which is pretty shocking. I mean, that's got to have a huge impact on Iran. And I saw a thing in the Financial Times this morning that there were protests in the streets in Iran, in Tehran, yesterday. Could this, if the pressure is great enough on the Iranian government, might it provoke them to, rather than saying, oh, yeah, we'll come on bended knee to you guys and do exactly what you want, to instead say, we're going to shut down the Straits of Hormuz, and through which a very large percentage of the internationally traded oil in the world passes, and not just to the United States, by the way. And if they do that, might that be the thing that would lead us to World War III?
It's hard to envision anything other than an escalatory cycle right now. Donald Trump's offers of he's willing to negotiate with Iran without preconditions, which were then walked back by Mike Pompeo, who offered a bunch of preconditions. I think that in Iran, they are looking at those things, and politically, it's a non-starter, but there are a lot of question marks about, you know, who is running the policy in Washington? Is Trump serious? But this, you know, this whole approach is just, it's something that the Iranian, you know, government and in general, they're just allergic to, you know, this idea that they're going to be sort of forced to the table at the barrel of a gun. Yeah, this threat of closing the Strait of Hormuz, you know, it's not even the action of doing it. Even the threat is a form of leverage that that Iran has.
Has the Iranian government already issued that threat, or is that implicit?
They've suggested it. They maybe have not directly threatened that it's, you know, imminent. But, you know, if Iranian oil is taken off the market, it's likely going to mean that Saudi Arabia and others have to fill that gap, and they go into their excess capacity. So if they are running, you know, near their full capacity, and Iran actually takes some steps to, you know, suggest that it's going to do some things in the Strait of Hormuz, that could really, you know, do some bad things to the oil market, cause some real jitters, really spike the prices, and this could all happen, you know, ahead of the U.S. midterms. So I think, you know, I think Iran is looking at, you know, what kind of leverage do they actually have, because Donald Trump is going full bore with every piece of leverage that he has.
So
it's a
just
dangerous process.
Yeah, putting this in a historical context, back in the late 60s, early 70s, when we had, as I recall, two Arab oil embargoes or boycott embargoes, you know, produced significant inflation and some serious problems in the United States, but it didn't lead to war. To what extent was Iran involved in any of that, or was that principally the Sunni countries?
Gosh, you're asking me historical questions.
I'm sorry. That, you know, if you're not sure, that's fine. I'm just curious. So what can go ahead?
I'm pretty sure Iran actually was helpful to the U.S.
Yeah.
During the embargo.
Yeah, I think that was before the Shah fell, so that would make sense.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, thank you for remembering that. I should have remembered it before I asked the question. So what can we do, what can Americans do to encourage our government not to take steps that could lead directly to, I'm saying this, that could lead directly to nuclear war? The scenario that I envision is, you know, the Iranians close the Straits of Hormuz, the Saudis, the Americans, the Israelis, somebody attacks Iran. Iran reaches out to Russia and says, help us out here. Russia attacks the countries that attacked Iran, and boom, we're in World War III, a thermonuclear, possibly World War III. A, do you think that scenario is realistic? We've discussed this in the past. I'm curious your current thinking on this. And B, what can we do to prevent that?
Yeah, there are so many tripwires for an escalation towards war, and towards, I mean, exactly what you laid out, a war that brings in all of the parties who so far have been fighting proxy wars in the region, but never actually fighting directly against one another. So it's extremely dangerous. I think with sanctions, these are sort of, you know, these are the diplomatic version of a drone strike, where they almost are viewed as cost-free, that they can happen behind the scenes, and the American public is not really going to be aware of what we are doing. They inflict, you know, damage on populations, but largely out of the public eye. Sanctions, we're going to see humanitarian consequences. We are going to see medicine being denied to Iranians. We're going to see the all kinds of you know, aircraft that can't be repaired, and you know, the cost of goods is going to go up. And so I think it's really important that we talk about these things, and that, you know, these are being done in our names as Americans. Yeah. This is collective punishment in our name.
It seems to me that if people are in the streets in Tehran or in Iran, that given the type of government Iran has right now, that's going to work to the detriment of reformers like Rouhani, and to the benefit of hardline right-wingers who actually would not necessarily be all that worried about a war. They might see a war as a way of strengthening their power. And I'm concerned that Donald Trump might see the same thing. Jamal, we have half a minute here. Your thoughts?
Yeah, this is the comfort zone for the hardliners in Iran's government. They love being in this spot. I think that this may be the death knell of the experiment of engaging the United States, at least for now. And for Donald Trump, I don't think he knows what he's gotten into. I don't think he's actually wrapped his head around this. He thinks that this is North Korea part two, and he's going to get some summit out of this.
Right.
He is surrounded by some of the biggest warmongers, and so this is really dangerous.
Yeah, John Bolton in particular. Jamal Abdi, the Vice President for Policy at the National Iranian American Council, NIAC, NIAC.org is the website. You can tweet him at jabdi, A-B-D-I. Jamal, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
It's always great talking with you. I always learn something, and I'm very concerned about this. Thank you. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's 18 minutes past the hour. We'll be back with your calls and the news of the day right after this. And welcome back. Corky in Rochester, New York. Hey, Corky. It says here you want to disagree with me about what?
Hello, Tom.
Hey, Corky.
Yeah, I don't understand why people are so ignorant about the economy and how it works. Yeah, we got a great economy. Like you say, it was left over from Barack Obama.
And beyond that, it's not all that great.
Well,
an economy. Wages.
Like a car.
Yeah,
you got to go the speed limit. Otherwise, terrible things are going to happen.
Yeah.
When you pump $1 trillion into an already good economy, what you're doing is stepping on the gas, and you're driving erratic. And what's going to happen is you're going to have a crash, and you're not going to have any money to fix your economy.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And, you know, I noticed on Twitter some people saying to me, you know, why didn't you correct that guy about the economy? And I was really more interested in whether if the economy crashed, he was going to, continue supporting Trump. And I only had, at that point in time, I think 45 seconds until we were going to hit the break. So I had to make a choice. But I agree with you, Corky, to some extent, although I would not characterize this as a good economy. And there's like these conflicting reporting, right? There was the Financial Times was reporting a couple of days ago that wages are up some 2 or 3%. Actually, I saw it on MSNBC on Stephanie Ruhle's program too, that wages are up 2 or 3%. But wages are not. That includes all the compensation that all the CEOs, senior executives, and white collar workers are getting. If you just look at hourly wages, that which is the majority of the economy in the United States, it's well over half of people work on an hourly basis rather than on a salary. If you look at hourly wages, they're actually down this year over last year. So I don't see where this is all that great an economy unless you happen to be in the stock market. Corky? Oh, Corky went away. Okay. Let's see here. Rich in Calumet, Michigan. Hey, Rich, thanks for watching Free Speech. What's on your mind?
Hey, we have add something really kind of new and different to our voting ballots today. They added a third party.
You have an election in Michigan today?
Yes.
Oh, I didn't know that.
It's not the primaries. It's the, what do you call it, before the primaries, where you decide who's going to run for governor on the Democratic Party.
That's a primary. It's not the general election. Right. Okay.
Okay.
So,
well, anyways, they added, first off, they made it so you can only vote single party.
Right.
And then they added the, gosh darn it, I forget what they're called now, Libertarian.
Well, that's interesting. If they had added the Greens, I would say they're trying to hurt the Democrats. If they've added the Libertarians, that's going to take votes away from the Republicans.
Well, that's kind of what I was thinking, you know. I mean, it's like, well, what do we got two Republican parties here for?
Yeah.
Yeah, I find the whole thing kind of confusing.
Or two corporatist parties. Well, that's fascinating.
And they were trying to make it sound like it was going to take 45 minutes or more to vote, and I think I got in and out in less than 5 minutes.
Wow.
There wasn't very many people. Of course, I went on a time that I figured there wouldn't be very many people, but...
Yeah.
Yeah, it just seemed...
Isn't the Democratic candidate for governor, who's a progressive, his name is Al Saeed? Am I remembering that correctly?
Bernie backed.
So
I can't remember his first name now.
Yeah, it's going to be real interesting to see if he wins after, you know, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez was there, Bernie was there. The guy has really good progressive cred. Thank you, Rich. Well, welcome back. Mike in Wheaton, Maryland. Hey, Mike, what's on your mind?
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Good. What's up?
You know, have you ever heard of Negro Wall Street?
No.
Well, you can look it up. It's now been changed to Black Wall Street.
Okay.
But it was Tulsa, Oklahoma had a
community. Oh, yes, I have. And then you're talking about back in the day when the Klan rioted and killed all those people and all that stuff.
Well, it wasn't really the Klan. It was the white community that went, that became a mob, and that was when bombs were, you know, Molotov cocktails were dropped from airplanes, and based on a white woman lying again.
Yeah, like with Emmett Till. Yeah.
Right. And this was during the most segregated period, because the destruction of Black Wall Street or Negro Wall Street. I wish you'd do some research on it, because, you know, when people come here from faraway land, thousands of miles, when they come here, they create little enclaves, and they find things that are, in, you know, people that have it, you know, from the same place that have something in common. Okay.
And typically, at least for the first generation, although those enclaves tend not to last more than two generations. But yeah, I get your point.
Okay. Now, Black Wall Street having not failed by black people building businesses, building black banks, churches, institutions, you know, all kinds of stuff in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Mm-hmm. It was destroyed. So the principles that were practiced in Negro Wall Street, Tulsa, Oklahoma, between the turn of the century, 1900, and its destruction in 1921, are timeless principles, okay,
mm-hmm.
that we as black folk, we need to look at our, because we're not taught our history, so a lot of us are ignorant of that place.
Yeah, and nobody has taught that history, Mike.
Exactly.
And it's a major problem.
And you know, I'm kind of sick of being, you know, Malcolm X spoke of suffering peacefully. You know, and that's what we're constantly doing, is suffering peacefully.
Yeah.
And you know, you got Asian Americans rotating the dollar in America 21 days before it leaves their community.
Yeah. No, I get everything you're saying, Mike, and you're right. We do need to focus more on this. Thank you very much for the call and for the wake-up. I appreciate it. And thanks for listening to SiriusXM. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-808-9925.
It's the Tom Hartman Program. Speaking the truths the multinational corporations and the neoliberals would rather you didn't know all about. Right back with you. Welcome back. It's 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. I just wanted to catch you up real quickly on two things, and then I'll pick up your phone calls. The first is Ohio 12. This is where Danny O'Connor, the Democrat, is running. And this is fascinating. This is an email that I saw posted over at Democratic Underground earlier. Ohio 12 just heard back from Text the Vote. They had so many volunteers signing up to help that they went through their entire database by 10 a.m. this morning and have sent over 140,000 texts on behalf of Danny O'Connor. This is a get-out-the-vote effort. In a seat, the Republicans have won by over 35 points in each of the last two elections. This has to be a very good sign. You think? I mean, you know, whether Danny O'Connor wins or not, if it's a squeaker, you know, the Republicans won this by 35 points in the last elections. This should be an early indicator of what's happening in, I think, across the country, frankly. I mean, Ohio is kind of a bellwether state. The other is, in the first hour of the program, I was talking about how the new old neoliberal privatization playbook, how to take things like Social Security, the post office, your electric supply, the public schools, how to take things that used to be public functions, or in the case of like hospitals. I grew up in Michigan. In Michigan, there was a law on the books up until after I left in 78. I don't know when they repealed it, but that all hospitals had to be nonprofits. And now, of course, you got for-profit hospitals ripping people off. So how do they get from nonprofit to for-profit? How do they get from publicly owned, government-owned, to privately owned, corporate-owned? It's a four-step process. They defund or sabotage the program, you know, cutting money out of the post office, cutting money to the administration of Social Security and Medicare, so that cutting the money to the Veterans Administration, so that the wait times increase and the service degrades. Then they scream, "Oh my God, there's a crisis!" Number two, and then number three, they say, "To solve this crisis, we need to privatize this system," which is in part what happened a couple of years ago with the Veterans Administration. And then number four, ka-ching, the for-profit corporations start making money. This is from a piece by Lambert Strether over at nakedcapitalism.com. But this amazing thread developed on Twitter, he writes, an opponent of, quote, socialized medicine deployed the, quote, wait times talking point and then asked, tell me again how good Canadian healthcare is? And he was claiming, you know, oh, I hate, you know, my health care here in Canada because I have to wait a long time if I want a hip replacement. Here are the tweets that they got back. This was just an amazing thread. Eve Rickert tweets, I immigrated. This was the first one, right? This was the She tweeted back. She said, I immigrated from the U.S. to Canada in 2006, had top-of-the-line American insurance before moving, have had surgery and hospital stays in both countries. Canadian health care is just as high a quality, wait time similar, stress way lower. Why the stress lower? Because you don't have to worry about going bankrupt if you get sick. Cognitive insistence adds to the thread. Meanwhile, I was hospitalized and then had complications. I've subsequently had to file for bankruptcy. I have terrible credit now, which impacts every aspect of my life. Yay, America. Cognitive being an American. Then the Canadians weighed in. Joanna B. at Wandering Shop. Canadian healthcare is amazing. I went to the hospital critically ill and skipped any waits because it's triage-based. In other words, if you have an emergency or you have something that's really serious, you get seen immediately. The next 5 months included two readmissions for 15 weeks of total critical care and surgeries. My parents got a deep discount on parking by paying by the month. My entire hospitalization cost $22, and that was for the parking. Then she says, adds, oh, well, I guess there was a couple bucks a day that to have my own cable TV as well because I was bedbound with IVs in both arms, so I didn't want to go to the lounge or hold a book. Still amazing system. In the U.S., I'd be dead. Paula Simons weighs in, my husband needed brain surgery here in Canada. World-class neurosurgeons removed a wedge of his skull, used lasers to remove scar tissue on his temporal lobe, then put his skull back together. My biggest expenses were parking and snacks for stress eating. Terry K. writes, my father spent a week in a hospital, ambulance to the airport, air ambulance across the island, ambulance to second hospitals, 3 days there. Only cost was mom driving across the island to be with him in aforementioned parking and snacks. Zoe York replies, yes, my first son was born 7 weeks early and granola bars and a month-long parking pass were my only expenses. You want to know how good Canadian health care is? Take a seat, son. I got all day. Voyage Vixen weighs in, I love our Canadian healthcare system. Broke two bones in my leg, and the same day, an excellent surgeon fixed it. No wait, no cost. In USA, 45,000 people die a year from no healthcare coverage, and many others lose everything financially. And I would add, by the way, more than half of all bankruptcies in the United States are because somebody got sick. The number of bankruptcies in Canada because somebody got sick, zero. Zero. Corey replies, some people wait for some procedures because of triage. A life-threatening emergency will be cared for. I had my appendix out a few years ago, including ER, ultrasound, ambulance transport between hospitals, CT scan with contrast, IV fluids, meds, surgery, overnight stay, cost zero in Canada. John Cullen says, another appendectomy here in the hospital at 1, saw a doctor at 3, PM, right? At 1 p.m., saw the doctor at 3, ultrasound at 5, CAT scan at 6, on the surgery table at 8 p.m. Overnight stay, meds, and get this, the doctor found I also had a herniated belly button and fixed it for free. I got a 2-for-1 surgery, cost zero. That's the Canadian healthcare system. But the neoliberals nonetheless are going, oh my God, the wait times, oh my God. Chuck in Mosher, Louisiana. Hey, Chuck, thanks for listening to SiriusXM. What's up?
Hey, hear me?
I hear you just fine. What's on your mind today?
Hey, good to talk to you. I listen to you forever. The guy that called earlier talking about the stories he hears about Hillary Clinton's mentor being a racist, do you know that is Robert Byrd they're talking about?
So, yeah, in fact, somebody tweeted the link to Fox News about that. I didn't know that Robert Byrd was Hillary Clinton's mentor, number one. And number two, yeah, Robert Byrd, you know, when he was representing West Virginia, back in the day, pre-1965, was a member of the Klan, actually. He renounced that and apologized for it repeatedly. And, you know, I'd say the last 20 years of his life were pretty exemplary, wouldn't you?
Well, yeah, that's what I'm saying. Anytime I say anything about, you know, pointing out the racist tendencies of Trump, they always get back from all the right-wingers, oh, but Hillary Clinton's mentor was a member of the Klan. But they don't mention the fact that, you know, in his later years, he recanted his racist past. Plus, he was praised by the NAACP when he died as an exemplary, you know, human being, basically.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, these myths that Fox News creates just live on. And the sad fact that the Fox watchers, the Fox viewers, particularly the chronic Fox viewers, don't get is that Fox News was created by Roger Ailes and Rupert Murdoch. Rupert Murdoch is a billionaire. Roger Ailes used to work in the Nixon White House. When Roger Ailes worked in the Nixon White House, he proposed something called GOP TV. There's a chapter about this in my book, The Crash of 2016, and it caused me to get disinvited from Fox News for 2 years, this chapter on the book. And Roger Ailes...
That's not a surprise.
Yeah, Roger Ailes proposed GOP TV, let's create our own television network, and the Nixon administration couldn't get funding for it. And so finally, Roger found a billionaire who wanted to promote the interests of billionaires and get average working people to be voting in a way that would help billionaires. And that was, of course, Rupert Murdoch. And he had done the same thing in the UK with newspapers. And so, he created Fox News. He lost $100 million a year for 5 years, almost a half a billion dollars, before he made the first penny. And people say, oh, Air America was a big failure. They went bankrupt with $17 million in debt. It's crazy.
And he's the reason we have so many ignorant people in the country these days.
Yeah, but the whole point of Fox News is, you know, a network owned by a billionaire, you know, put together by Roger Ailes, a multi-millionaire with hosts like Sean Hannity, who's a multi-millionaire, promoting the interests of the very rich and causing people to think that they should vote in a way that would help the very rich. Because somehow that's going to, stop abortion or something. I mean, you know, they'll find some little hot-button issue, or they'll just lie, like about Robert Byrd. That's pretty breathtaking.
Yep.
Chuck, thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for listening to SiriusXM, and thanks for correcting the record there. I appreciate it. Marilyn in Phoenix, Arizona. Hey, Marilyn, thanks for watching us on Free Speech TV. What's on your mind?
Oh, hi. I just found you a few days ago because I fell and hurt my hip and was looking for something better to watch on television. And you brought up something on TV just a minute ago that I haven't heard too many people talk about, which really gets my goat, and that is the privatization or the corporatization of our government, mm-hmm. which actually takes away the idea of government. I wanted to ask you what you think about Ronald Reagan when he first said, why let the government do what the corporations can do cheaper and more efficient, and how that is not removing the original intent of the democracy of us being run by the people for the people.
Yeah. Reagan might have believed that, and a lot of people did believe that in the 1980s when Reagan became president, that corporations do things more efficiently and less expensively than government. And I suppose if you're looking at the Soviet government, you know, where they were making cars and computers and TV sets, it might have actually even been true, although I've never seen a study that demonstrated that. Government doesn't have the overhead of profit. On the other hand, business has, in order to maximize profit, the incentive to streamline their operations. So there's a balance between the two. But the fact of the matter is that Reagan wanted to privatize basically everything. And there are a lot of things that government actually does better than private industry that are you know, those are the things that have to do with the commons. They have to do with all of us. So I was horrified when Reagan started promoting that. But it was not new to his administration. I mean, Nixon was saying the same thing. That's just an old Republican meme about let's just turn everything over to the billionaire class. Let's turn everything over to the corporations. We don't need we the people doing anything for we the people when the billionaires will take care of us. And if they don't take care of us, you can put a little can in a 7-Eleven and say, I need an appendectomy. Please drop a dollar in the can. I mean, that's the Republican way, right? And yeah. Marilyn, thank you for the call. Very well said. I appreciate it. And you know, you brought up a great topic. We'll be right back. It's coming up on 16 minutes before the hour, or 14 minutes before the hour. Stick around.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
As we head into our last 15 minutes of the show here, back with more of your calls in just a moment. And welcome back, David, watching us on Free Speech TV in Torrance, California. Hey, David, what's on your mind today?
Yes, hi. I like your program, and I'm one of your supporters. For the first time in a long time, I'm seeing that Democratic candidates, they're seeing how important the messaging is, and they're seeing that the messaging is actually getting some effect even in the Republican areas.
I think Bernie was a big wake-up, you know, when Bernie's, some of his huge victories, Michigan and West Virginia, totally unexpected.
Yeah. Yes. One of the things that I am, since a lot of progressive people are watching or listening to your program, I think it's not a bad idea for the people to propose what their proper messaging would be for the upcoming election. Like you had the same kind of things. You asked people which candidates they like for the election. Mm-hmm. How about asking people what messaging they like for the upcoming election?
And yeah, those surveys have been done, David. And what people have found, what Democrats have found anyway, the Democratic pollsters, is that the number one issue right now in the United States is health care. And I think most Americans would love to have something like the Canadian system, number one. The second issue seems to be the economy and economic security. And that ties into good jobs, raising the minimum wage, strengthening labor unions, flipping our Supreme Court decisions upside down. And then there's a whole bunch of issues that kind of come into the third tier there.
Yeah, I think one of good message that I propose is that economic justice for working Americans. That would be a good message.
That's that second tier message that I was mentioning, and I think that in particular the progressive candidates are picking this stuff up and running with it. And the rest of the Democratic Party is slowly kind of waking up to the reality of this. But I expect that by November, you're going to, and certainly by the 2020 election, you're going to see so-called mainstream Democrats, Democrats who typically take a lot of corporate money, who've even been taking money from health insurance companies and big hospital groups, starting to say it's time for Medicare for all. It really is. And you know, because they're more interested in getting reelected than they are in getting an extra $1 million in their campaign coffers. Usually there's a relationship between the two, but when you've got a really hot issue like health care for all, Medicare for all, something that, you know, Bernie really made real for Americans in a very real way, and then Hillary Clinton did as well. I think that, you know, that's something that you can't just kind of blow off. I'm not sure where the third, fourth, and fifth messages should be, David. Do you have thoughts on where they should be? What they should be? Excuse me?
I don't know. I just this is
okay.
I just
I would say something, you know, broadly. I think
at you and see what you think about it.
Yeah. Well, thank you, David. I appreciate the call. I would say broadly something like, you know, stop neoliberalization, but that's not a bumper sticker, right? But stop privatizing things and build the commons. You know, rebuild America's infrastructure. Make America great again. I can't believe I said that. But that's what we need to do. I mean, not in the Trump sense, and you know, but, well, actually, Trump campaigned. We're going to spend more money on infrastructure. It hasn't happened, but he campaigned on it. We'll be back. Welcome back, Donald, in Aurora, Illinois. Hey, Donald, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Social Security and Medicare, it really worries me. And I've called several times in the past about this. I've been on Social Security and Medicare for the last 3 years. Thank God for Medicare. I lost my house. I had two cancer surgeries. People don't know what they're going to lose until they lose it. Then they're going to find out.
Right.
What worries me about this whole thing is even if we take back the house, they had made such a mess of this of our budget that could it be so where the Democrats might be forced to cut Social Security and Medicare to accommodate, you know, just to keep it going? Would that ever happen?
Well, that's the plan. And in fact, I mean, they even got President Obama to say that he would consider a chain CPI, which is a cut to Social Security. It backfired on him politically, and he backed away from it really quick. But the Republicans have been pushing him to do that, and some of the more quote moderate end quote Democrats. You know, who were taking money from the banks, who would make a fortune if Social Security was privatized, but I'm frankly more sanguine about the possibility that we're going to see Social Security and Medicare strengthened rather than cut. I think that the tide has turned, and I
hope so.
Yeah,
I'm hoping you're right. You know, another thing that bothers me. The Social Security and Medicare, every time I hear people talking that they're going to get, even politicians, you don't see any retaliation from any of the senior citizens. Where are they screaming? They should be screaming about this. They should be on the phone. I hardly hear any of them talking about it. Are they all millionaires?
No, the problem is that the AARP, which just kind of gives milquetoast lip service to these kind of topics rather than being an activist organization, gets the vast majority of their money from UnitedHealthcare. And I mean, the vast majority. They're the AARP headquarters in D.C., I've been there, or I've walked by anyway, you know, is mansion-esque. You know, it's money pouring all over the place. And UnitedHealthcare is making so much money on Medicare. I mean, the Republicans drilled holes in Medicare so it only covers 80% of your expenses. And so you have to buy insurance, supplemental insurance. And AARP sells the supplemental insurance from UnitedHealthcare. UnitedHealthcare has made so much money on this that their CEO, Stephen J. Hemsley, has made over $1 billion. He's taken over $1 billion out of that company. His predecessor, they called him Dollar Bill McGuire, took $1.5 billion out of UnitedHealthcare. Just one guy. And, you know, there's over 100 executives making over $1 million a year at UnitedHealthcare. So, you know, all these sweet ads and stuff, but you know, AARP knows which side their bread is buttered on, and they're not taking on the neoliberals, they're not taking on the big corporations. And that's the unfortunate part about it, Donald. Donald, thanks for the call. We need activist organizations for boomer seniors, and you know, unfortunately, there's not a good one out there, at least that I know of. Lindsay in Florence, Kentucky. Hey, Lindsay, what's up?
Hi, I just wanted to make a comment about wait times as far as Canadian healthcare versus here goes. Myself and my son both have some chronic conditions that require us to see specialists. And we live outside of the Cincinnati, Ohio area. So we have quite a few larger hospital systems. We have a large research university hospital here. And even with the plethora of providers that we have available to us, my son's neurologist wait time every year as an established patient, we schedule out 7 months
in advance. Yeah.
So when I hear these people say, oh, Canadian wait time, for a new patient, his pediatric neurologist schedules 11 months in advance.
Yeah.
And that's if you have a legitimate reason to go to her. If you are still in the diagnosis phase and you don't have a diagnosis yet, you can't get on her calendar.
Yeah,
so heaven forbid you have something legitimate wrong with you, you're still getting passed specialist to specialist through the system before you can actually see the person that will fix it for you. Close to a year as a new patient. So when I hear these wait time comments, I'm like, you know what? If it's less than 7 months, I'm calling it a win.
Yeah, there you go. We saw that Louise and I experienced the same thing both when we moved to D.C. and then when we moved back to Portland. In both cases, we contacted local doctors and, you know, we'd like to be a new patient for you. And in D.C., the wait time was well over a year just for the first meeting with the doctor. And here in Portland,
right,
it was at least 5 or 6 months, as I recall. And, you know, what happens is the people who can afford to go to concierge docs, where you pay $500 a year or $1,000 or a couple thousand, in D.C.
Yeah.
It was $3,000 a year for a couple, they can afford to do it, and they get in right away, and everybody else is, you know, SOL. You got to go to the emergency room if you need your Synthroid refilled or something like that. Lindsay, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. And you nailed it. Thanks so much for being with us today. We'll be back tomorrow. It'll be fascinating. I'm guessing one of our major topics of conversation tomorrow will be what happened in the election in Ohio today. I'm keeping an eye on that tonight. It's going to be an amazing day. And in the meantime, don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It takes all of us. And that includes you. There's a lot of great organizations out there you can participate with, a lot of ways you can make change happen. Get inside the political parties, Democratic or Republican. You know, get out there, get active, tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartmann. For audio and video archives, visit tomhartmann.com.